Hi, welcome to Politics and Science. Today we're doing an assortment of Arne Gundersen analysis. He has a website with his wife Maggie called Fair Winds, FairWinds.com, FairWinds.com. And there you'll find some Fukushima updates. So, it's the 27th of April 2011, and these shows run from the 6th to the 26th of April. And part of FairWinds.com is a nonprofit dedicated to educating people about nuclear power. And Arne Gundersen is an independent nuclear engineer and analyst. And if you want to help, he and his wife Maggie bring an independent analysis to issues of nuclear power. You can do that by making a tax-deductible donation at their website, FairWinds.com, and many thanks to them for making these audio files available. And you can see them yourself at FairWinds.com. Now for the first segment. On April 6th, Arne Gundersen discussed the inconsistencies between what the NRC, TEPCO, and the nuclear industry are saying privately and publicly. Documents from the French nuclear firm Areva and the NRC reveal what industry knows about the Fukushima disaster. Here's Arne Gundersen.
Hi, I'm Arne Gundersen of Fairwinds Associates. It's Wednesday, April 6th. In my previous update, I talked about the possibility of an inadvertent criticality occurring in Fukushima 1. And that was based on four things. It was based on a neutron beam being detected 13 times. It was based on the presence of chlorine-38. It was based on tellurium-129 being detected. And it was based on iodine-131 and 132 being detected. Well, since I made that update to you, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric, has pulled the report upon which I based it. The tellurium data, they say, is no longer accurate. Now, when you're in a mode like Tokyo Electric is in, you would hope that the information you're using is accurate, and that's a serious concern that inaccurate information is being used in decision-making at TEPCO. This isn't the only time, there's a couple of these instances. When the neutron beam report came out, TEPCO denied that. Despite the fact that the quote was from their own spokesman. There was a report of incredibly high radiation in the ocean, and TEPCO denied that and lowered the report. Still incredibly high, but 100 times lower. And Dr. Richard Leahy, a General Electric scientist of great renown, was quoted that Unit 2 had a meltdown. Again, TEPCO denied that. So I guess I'm concerned about, one, the reliability of information coming out of TEPCO, but also the fact that what appears to be happening in private at TEPCO is not being relayed to the public. It's not just TEPCO that this is occurring with. Today, the New York Times ran a story about a report circulated within the Nuclear Regulatory Commission dating back to March 26th, where the NRC staff has identified significant problems and dangers at Fukushima. Basically, we're not out of the woods yet. The problems that the staff is aware of, but yet not really sharing with Congress or with the general public, include the fact that there's an awful lot of mud inside this nuclear reactor. Now, we've been talking about that for a week or more because of the seawater that's been injected into the reactor. It's not coming out. And it's building up inside. Well, the NRC is concerned about that too. They just didn't tell you and I. They're concerned that the weight of the building with all this water in it might make it unstable in the case of an earthquake. They're concerned that a recriticality, like we talked about last time, might occur. They're also concerned about hydrogen being recreated and another explosion occurring. And finally, they're also concerned about plutonium, which likely was ejected from the fuel pools during the explosions. Now, the NRC believes that this plutonium was ejected several miles away from the reactor. and is also on site and may have been bulldozed into the soil. Well, all this is happening inside the NRC. They're telling Congress and you and I that the situation's difficult but under control. It's not just the NRC that's saying this, it's large nuclear corporations, including one called Areva, which is a French nuclear conglomerate, probably one of the largest in the industry. As reported in the New York Times on March 23rd, there was an invitation-only meeting at Stanford University on the 21st of March. So this is 10 days after the accident, where Areva presented a report indicating some pretty significant problems that the public was not being made aware of. And we've been able to get a hold of the Areva report that was presented there. Now, the Areva report is pretty damning, but in fact, there's information in it that's wrong. And it's and I will next time be discussing, in fact, the problems with the Areva report that actually make the situation worse. But the Areva report talks about the fact that it's known that the nuclear fuel in all three reactors reached 5,000 degrees. Now that's beyond the melting point of stainless steel and beyond the melting point of zircaloy, which means that the disintegration of the core is pretty obvious. The Areva report talks about Unit 2 in particular and identifies that the core, that the containment was breached by a hydrogen explosion. And, you know, we look at units 1, 3, and 4 and see the roof blown off, and 2 looks pretty good. What happened at unit 2, though, was that the hydrogen built up inside and somehow ignited. That's unknown why. And sort of like a sneeze with your nose closed, you're going to pop your eardrums. Well, that's what happened at unit 2, but it likely breached the containment. So Areva and the nuclear industry know that and really haven't been sharing it with us. The other thing that Areva report talks about is that they recommend control of crops and dairy products out to 50 kilometers. That's about 30 miles away from the plant. That means that they believe that radiation has exceeded well beyond what the emergency evacuation zone is, and that both crops and dairy products may be contaminated. Areva also spends a lot of time talking about Unit 4. Now, that's the one that has no fuel in the reactor, but exploded anyway. And they basically said that this was a core melt in fresh air. The reason the core melted on Unit 4, Areva believes, is that the fuel pool cracked from the earthquake. So the water didn't boil out of Unit 4, like we've been led to believe. There was a crack in the fuel pool from the earthquake, and now with no water, a zircaloy hydrogen reaction was inevitable. The last thing that the Areva report notices is that this was probably the largest release is coming from Unit 4 because there's no containment, and they basically say all of the fission products can be volatilized. Well, finally, industry insiders who are aware of the Areva presentation have told me that the person who presented the presentation said this. It's almost an exact quote. "Clearly, we are witnessing one of the greatest disasters in modern time." Well, in the private meetings, Areva is saying that this is a serious issue. But in public, the nuclear renaissance continues to move forward, both within the nuclear industry and within the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I will update you on this Areva report and identify the problems within it in my next presentation. But I wanted to let you know that I will be trying to filter out from all of these sources reliable information to pass on to you in the future.
On April 13th, once again, nuclear engineer Arne Gundersen discusses why TEPCO's announcement of an increased accident severity level should not be a surprise. He also discusses similarities among the Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and Fukushima nuclear accidents, and how governments are once again limiting public access to accurate radiation dose information. Lastly, Gundersen responds to the overwhelming number of email inquiries regarding the Fukushima accident. This is April 13th, 2011.
Hi, I'm Arnie Gunderson from Fairwinds, and today is Wednesday, April 13th. I'd like to talk to you today about three things that have come up in the last couple of days. The first is that Tokyo Electric has raised the accident severity level to a 7. The second is some similarities that I'm seeing between how this accident's progressing and Three Mile Island and Chernobyl in regards to controlling the information. And the third is I received a lot of emails about what should I do here in the States and what should I do in different countries about potentially changing lifestyle habits or leaving. So I'd like to talk about those today. But the first one is yesterday, TEPCO changed the rating of this accident from a 5 to a 7. And what that means is they had been saying it was like Three Mile Island, and now they're saying it's as severe as Chernobyl. Well, I felt that way for almost the last month, and frankly, it should come as no surprise to anyone that this accident is as bad. There's 7 nuclear reactors and fuel pools that are not being cooled here, and there's been 3 meltdowns and an explosion in a fuel pool. So the net effect is that this is certainly a catastrophe on the level of Chernobyl, and has been for the last couple of weeks rather. You know, it's interesting because before this accident occurred, the worst that anybody ever thought would be one nuclear reactor, not with a meltdown, but with 1% nuclear fuel failed, containment retained its integrity, and this is 3 nuclear reactors, a fuel pool, etc. This is about 1,000 times worse than ever anticipated by the nuclear planners. The second thing is that I've noticed some disturbing similarities between the information that's coming out of Fukushima and what came out of Chernobyl and what came out of TMI. You may remember I was an expert in that trial in the 90s. And it seems as if the government and also the people that own the reactors begin to try to control the information and limit a couple of things. They try to limit the amount of radiation released, and they try to limit the effect of that radiation on people. And then the other thing is they try to delay evacuations until they're too late. I saw that at Three Mile Island, and I saw that at Chernobyl, and I see it beginning to occur here too. Now, back on the 30th anniversary of Three Mile Island, I was invited to Harrisburg, to the Capitol, and I gave a speech, and it's up here on the website right next to the video here. It was about what I call the three myths of Three Mile Island. And if trends continue, we could call it the three myths of Fukushima as well. I'm hoping that in an internet era that more information will be available to more independent scientists, and that governments and utilities don't try to monopolize that data. It's about a half an hour video, and at the beginning of it, you'll hear music in the background. While I was giving the speech, there was a marching band in a rotunda next to the room. So I ask you, if you watch the video, to bear with me for the first 10 minutes for the music in the background. Right after my speech, Dr. Steve Wing gave a speech about the actual health effects of Three Mile Island. And because the radiation releases have been downplayed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and by the Three Mile Island itself, we've been led to believe there were no injuries. Dr. Wing's data clearly shows that that's wrong. And I'm concerned that we're beginning to see the industry circle the wagons and make that presentation. I heard it on NPR today, for example. So please be aware that the trend of trying to consolidate information is not new, but I think in the internet era we stand a chance to break that. The last thing today is that I've had many emails from people saying, what should I do? Should I move? Should I change the way I eat? A lot of the U.S. government sites are down right now. And I'm not going to attribute motive to that, but I will let you know that I'm concerned that we're not getting the radiation data that we should be getting from the U.S. government sites. There's a lot of independent scientists out there that are gathering data, and I think that probably by next week I'll be in a position to better estimate what that is. I guess if you're concerned, washing leafy vegetables can't hurt, and watching milk consumption can't hurt. But short of that, I really don't have any data to share with you this week. I think maybe next week we will. Now, finally, two things. I promised more thorough review of the Arriva report. With events like this upgrade to a 7, I haven't gotten around to that yet. I will. And last but certainly not least, on Friday, I've been invited to a 2-hour television show with Deepak Chopra and several other nuclear experts. It's going to be accessible via the net, and there's a link on this page to link you to it. It'll be at 6 o'clock Eastern Time on Friday. That probably will be the video for Friday from my standpoint, and I hope you can click that link and watch it. Finally, Fairwinds actually has a day job, and making these presentations is not it. I hope that you can look toward that donate button on our page and help support this. We're not drawing any salaries for making these presentations. However, keeping up the web and the web presence is costly, and I hope you choose to do it. I will get back to you in a couple of days, but let me leave you with one last thought, and that's everybody knows the moment that Three Mile Island and the moment that Chernobyl happened, but who knows when they end? Thank you.
Now, on April 18th, Arne Gundersen analyzes new pressure and temperature data from the Fukushima reactors and containments. TEPCO recently denied that the fuel pool in Unit 4 was experiencing a partial inadvertent criticality, despite the finding of radioactive iodine-131, an isotope with an 8-day half-life. The utility blamed the iodine on deposition resulting from the explosion of the other buildings. Gundersen takes an in-depth look at TEPCO's theory. Lastly, he discusses the FDA decision not to monitor fish for radioactivity.
Hi, I'm Arne Gundersen from Fairwinds, and it's Monday, April 18th. I've been away at New York City for several days on business, and I wanted to say it's nice to be back. I appreciate the emails we've been receiving, both the ones saying keep it up, but separately, I've gotten some good technical information from some of you as well, and I really appreciate that. I wanted to talk about three things. The first is the condition of reactors 1, 2, and 3. The second is the condition of the fuel pool in Unit 4. And the third is the monitoring of fish. The condition of reactors 1, 2, and 3, is actually as a result of several of you who sent me a really great link about the reactor parameters as measured by TEPCO. The first graph I want to look at is the pressure inside the reactor. Unit 1 is on the left, Unit 2 is in the middle, and Unit 3 is on the right. You'll look at those and you'll see there's no pressure inside of Unit 2 and inside of Unit 3. That's a good thing. That shows that the reactor itself is under no stress. There is pressure relatively high, 150 pounds, inside of Unit 1, and I don't know why. I'll have to get back to you on that. But let's go over to the next slide, which begins to make this a little bit curious. The next graph is unit 1, 2, 3 again, but it's the temperature inside the reactors. If you look at unit 3, the temperature is right at boiling, which is really great. Very low pressure, very low temperature. That's basically about the best they could hope for right now. But look at unit 2. Unit 2 shows 300 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 150 on the centigrade scale, inside unit 2. That can't happen if it's water. There's a in thermodynamics, there's this thing called the steam tables, and water at room pressure, which is zero on these charts, boils at 212. You can't have water or steam at 300 degrees when there's no extra pressure put on it. Well, what does that tell me? That tells me that the that what they're measuring in unit 2 is not water or steam at all. It's hot air or hot hydrogen. And that's a problem. It tells me that unit 2 is not being cooled. Now, if you look at unit 1, the temperatures are higher still, but the pressure in unit 1, going back to the other graph, is high also. So it can have water inside it and still be water cooled, but unit 2 cannot. Now, we've talked about it before that unit 2 has a hole in the bottom of it, so I guess we shouldn't be surprised that the pressure is zero, but we should be very concerned that we're exhausting hot gases out the top of that reactor. The last graph is a series, again, unit 1, 2, 3, of the containment pressure. Now, that's the box that the reactor is inside of. And that shows that basically unit 1 and unit 3 have slight containment pressure, and unit 2 has no containment pressure. If you look at 1 and 2 and 3, there's two lines on 1 and 3. There's only one on unit 2. Then that means there's no pressure at the bottom of the containment. We know that to be true because there's evidence of an explosion causing a leak. So this graph clearly shows that unit 2's containment is leaking. The previous two graphs show that unit 2 is not getting water inside the core. And I don't really think that the mainstream media has really addressed that unit 2 is the cause of all of this radioactive pollution out into the ocean, because its containment doesn't have integrity and its reactor doesn't have integrity. So whatever water is going in the top is going out the bottom through the containment and into the surrounding soils. It's the biggest concern. Unit 3 seems to be out of the woods, and unit 1 is somewhere in between. Now I want to talk to you about the unit 4 fuel pool. On Friday, TEPCO had a release that said that they had measured the water in the pool, and they found that a little tiny cubic centimeter, about that big cubic centimeter, had 250 disintegrations per second of iodine. Now, you'll remember that iodine is one of those fission products that break up. And I believe that when you find iodine in a fuel pool, it's an indication that a fission reaction has occurred. Now, it can't have come from Unit 4, because Unit 4 has been shut down for 5 months, unless a reaction occurred after the accident as a result of the accident. Now, I think TEPCO anticipated my argument, and they said, no, that's not what happened. The iodine fell from the sky from the explosions in Units 1, 2, and 3, called iodine deposition. Well, let's take TEPCO at its word. A little box this big has 250 disintegrations per second now, but the accident occurred 32 days ago. So that's four half-lives. So if it's 250 now, it was 500 8 days ago, 1,000 8 days before that, and 2,000 8 days before that. So that little box, when these plants were exploding, had iodine fall into it to the tune of 2,000 disintegrations per second. Now, that little box is a centimeter by centimeter by centimeter. If we look at a cubic meter, there's going to be 100 by 100 by 100 of those little boxes, or a million of those little boxes in a cubic meter. So if we multiply that 2,000 by a million, we get 2,000 megabecquerels in a cubic meter. Well, that pool This is the last piece of math here. That pool is 15 meters deep. So imagine these boxes stacked 15 high. So we take the 2,000 megabecquerels times 15, we get 30,000 megabecquerels in that column. Well, if we take TEPCO at its word, all of that fell from the top. That's a square meter. What that means is that the iodine deposition on a square meter was 30,000 megabecquerels. That's pushing the numbers at Chernobyl. So if we take TEPCO at its word, they had Chernobyl level releases on the other units, which caused the iodine to fall on unit four. Now there's two other pieces of that though. Iodine is a gas. And I don't know how a gas falls from the sky in these kind of quantities and gets absorbed into a fuel pool. There's probably a 1,000-to-1 factor there too. And the last piece is, if we take TEPCO at its word that the iodine fell from the sky, unit one exploded first. Unit two exploded next. Unit three exploded next, sorry, and unit two exploded third. Unit four still had its roof on during all of those explosions. So it's hard to imagine iodine deposition getting into the fuel pool as a result of the explosions in units one, two, and three. But if we take TEPCO at its word, they're claiming basically a Chernobyl level release. Then I'm saying that it could be that, or it could be that the fuel pool had a self-sustaining chain reaction. Last thing I wanted to talk about was fish. Over the weekend, the FDA announced it would not be monitoring fish on the West Coast, and I don't think that's a good idea. If there's anything you can do as a result of these videos, besides staying informed, and I appreciate that, it's to contact your congressperson and say, hey, you know, we're citizens here. We deserve to have our fish monitored. I don't think we'll find anything initially, but over the next year, as the little fish get eaten by bigger fish, and the plume spreads, we might. And it just seems to be a prudent health risk that can be avoided by proper monitoring. Well, thank you. And thank you for everyone for their emails. And for those of you who have pushed the donate button, I also appreciate it. I'll get back to you as soon as I have other information to share. Thanks.
Okay, now it's we're moving forward in time. It's April 21st, and Arne Gundersen is joined by epidemiologist Dr. Stephen Wing, and they're discussing the consequences of the Fukushima radioactive fallout on Japan, the United States, and the world. What are the long-term health effects, and what should the governments do to protect citizens? This is April 21st.
Hi, I'm Arne Gundersen from Fairwinds, and a little change of scene here tonight. We're going to try some technology and talk in an interview with a renowned epidemiologist, Dr. Steve Wing, who's at the University of North Carolina. Steve and I spoke together in Harrisburg about 2.5 years ago on Three Mile Island, and Steve's longer presentation about the health effects of Three Mile Island is on our website. You can find it there. So, Steve, we've been getting lots of questions about, is there a safe amount of radiation?
Well, the generally accepted thinking about the safe dose is that no, there is no safe dose in terms of the cancer or genetic effects of radiation. There's the assumption is that of most people is that there's a linear no threshold dose response relationship, and that just means that as the dose goes down, the risk goes down, but it never disappears.
So in terms of Fukushima, then, the people near to the reactor would obviously have much higher dose, and the people, on this side of the Pacific Ocean would have much lower. But so the contamination then is getting spread out.
That's right. So Of course, when the Fukushima situation first started, we heard lots of news media talking about there's no threat to health, which just flies in the face of all the standard models and all the studies that have been done over a long period of time of radiation and cancer. And they could have been talking about acute effects, and those occur only at higher doses, such as the types of doses that the workers are receiving at the plant, some of the workers. But as the radiation clouds move away from Fukushima and move far away to other continents and around the world, the doses are spread out. But it's important for people to know that spreading out a given amount of radiation dose among more people, although it reduces each person's individual risk, it doesn't reduce the number of cancers that result from that amount of radiation. So having millions and millions of people exposed to a very small dose could produce just as much cancer as 1,000 or a few thousand people exposed to that same dose.
So let's put aside for a minute the people that are working there, because they're getting extraordinarily high doses, and in some cases that probably increase the likelihood of cancer by, you know, 10 or 20% because of the radiation they got. But for the civilians who are not not members of the staff, what does that mean for the continental U.S. in general?
Well, that's a question a lot of people have right now, is that they are concerned. Should they take iodine? Should they avoid certain foods? Should they move? And that kind of thing. And what I would suggest to people thinking about that is that as the contamination from Fukushima is spread out, it's just more difficult to avoid exposure by changing your behavior, your eating habits, or where you live. Now, if you live near Fukushima, you can move away, and it makes a big difference because the doses there are very high. But the doses here are much, much lower. So in North America, it's much more difficult to change your dose in any significant way by moving or changing your diet. Now, this is in part because we don't know that much about exactly how contaminated any place or any food is, but still, the doses are much, much lower. So I would encourage people not to become too concerned about themselves only, because there's another problem, which is that if people focus exclusively on the concern about radiation from Fukushima, they could become distracted from other sources of radiation or other types of exposures in air and water and food that can cause cancer. And so it's the world is complex, and it's for those of us far away, it's very much hard to treat this as something that we can handle ourselves as individuals. Now, that's a little bit different when it comes to our public officials. They have the capacity to issue statements about what things to avoid if they find contamination, and that's very important. So they have the potential to be able to influence the food supply or to make recommendations that can be followed by thousands or millions of people. And I'm certainly supportive of that in the event that contamination is found that people can avoid.
So in an earlier video, I was talking about how I felt that the FDA should be sampling fish in the Pacific, especially the ones that are up in the food chain, the tuna and the salmon and things like that. And that's an appropriate public health response. But for an individual catching a trout on a stream in Idaho, to worry about that particular fish is not a reasonable idea?
Yeah, I think there are probably other things more important to worry about, including other sources of radiation.
Okay. So if you, so you're basically suggesting that as a collective, as the country as a whole, or perhaps the world, but certainly the closer you get the Pacific coast, et cetera, as a collective group, we should be concerned, and there will be cancers, but also as individuals on this side of the Pacific, there's not much to do to that changes the likelihood that you'll be it. Is that right?
That's true. I think that's a good way to put it. I think what to me, as a public health response, that what's most important for us is to be involved in taking collective action, which means that we should be focusing on putting pressure on people in government and in the energy industry to come up with an energy policy that minimizes harm. And right now, that it's a very complicated thing to do, but building nuclear power plants that are potentially going to have problems like what we're seeing at Fukushima, or other problems that we have not yet observed, just as the problems at Fukushima had never been observed in the history of the nuclear industry before, that we need to be more creative about imagining what things might happen and working towards a more sane energy policy.
You know, I was talking recently and the three big accidents in my career, Three Mile Island in 79 and then Chernobyl in 86 and now this one, they all happened for reasons that the experts never anticipated. And I think that, when you look at the unknown unknowns, if we were going to quote famous people in the past, that really when we're looking at this technology, it seems like the things we plan for are not what happens, but the things that we don't know or underestimate are what comes around and causes the accidents.
That's very true. So adopting technologies that minimize the consequences of something unforeseen, I would argue, is a key idea for all of us to think about and to become involved in our civic life, working for those kinds of changes at the local level, at our national level, and internationally. Because these are problems that will go on for a very long time. In the case of the nuclear industry, we have spent fuel that is being stored on site, which is one of the big problems at Fukushima. And we have as yet to determine its final fate. And so there are big problems that I'm afraid those who have led us into this situation have not fully faced.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight. And we'll touch base with you as this develops. If there is a rain out, a significant radiation deposition on the United States, we'll get you back on, because I think, our discussion was low level spread over a lot of people. But, if we do have a lot of precipitation that drives a lot of radiation into a local area, we'll definitely get you back on.
Great. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you. And next, as things develop, we'll get back to you. Fairwinds, Arne Gunderson. Good night.
April 25th, Arne Gunderson implores Congress and the NRC to think outside the box. He's asking them to pause licensing of new nukes and the 20-year life extensions of the nuclear plants until the lessons learned from Fukushima are applied. Fairwinds Associates, where I got this analysis, recommends that regulators look at the feasibility of emergency evacuation plans, containment leakage, and aging management plans for the 40-year-old Fukushima model reactors, such as the one we have down at Vermont Yankee. All right, so this is April 25th. One more to go after this.
I'm Arnie Gunderson from Fairwinds, and today's Monday, April the 25th. And I wanted to look back today at the 6 weeks since Fukushima and see what kind of lessons can be learned at this early date and what the United States should be doing as a result of that. Well, the industry had a worst case assumption of 1% failed fuel on one reactor. And in fact, we've got multi-unit sites and we've got 70% failed fuel at three reactors at Fukushima. You know, clearly what we thought on March 10th was worst case is in fact not worst case at all. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission assumed a containment leak at 0.5% a day. At Fukushima, we have three reactors, reactor containments leaking at enormously amounts more than that. One is water is literally pouring out of the side of it. Back before March 10th, the industry assumed that all these releases would get sucked out of the buildings and pulled up a stack and released very high into the air to minimize exposure. At Fukushima, the stacks didn't work. The worst case assumption that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission ever thought possible was that batteries could be used for 8 hours and then everything would be back to normal. And of course, at Fukushima, that didn't work either. And also, the industry always assumed that their worst case, that people would have to be evacuated out for 10 miles and in a day or two or three, they'd be allowed to come back in. Well, the United States State Department has suggested that people move out if they're within 50 miles of the plant, and no one knows when they're coming back in. We simply haven't planned for the really worst case. If you look at Fukushima, we've got three reactors in one form of a meltdown or another, and we've got four spent fuel pools that have had fires, explosions, and leaks. Again, in one form of meltdown or another. That's seven problems. If this were a road race, we'd have a seven-car accident. And if this were a road race, we'd put out a yellow flag and slow things down. And yet here in America, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission isn't putting out the yellow flag. It isn't slowing things down. As a matter of fact, it's continuing to license reactors to run for an extra 20 years or to have their power increased. Even though we have, in the background, Fukushima looming over us. I think it's time to put out the yellow flag and slow things down. Here's an example. I have argued with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for 5 years. I've written expert report on expert report about containment leakage. I've given the Nuclear Regulatory Commission pictures of holes in the side of containment. Then they said, no, containments don't leak. I've given the Nuclear Regulatory Commission pictures of cracks in the side of containments. And they said, no, containments don't leak. There's 0% probability that a containment will leak. Well, at Fukushima, we've got three containments that are leaking, and yet the NRC continues to license new power plants based on the fact that we believe that the containments won't leak. I think in my professional career, there's been five major accidents. There's been near misses. There's been Three Mile Island. And the NRC blamed the operators for an operator error. There was Brown's Ferry. That was a fire that almost caused a meltdown. And it was caused by a maintenance guy looking for leaks with a candle. And the candle set the wires on fire. They blamed the maintenance practice. Then there was Chernobyl. And again, the industry blamed the operating practice. Then there was Davis-Besse. That was in 2000. And there a hole the size of a grapefruit was allowed to eat its way through the side of a nuclear reactor. And the industry blamed one guy for signing one line on one procedure. And ultimately, management paid millions of dollars in fines because it really was a management issue. And now there's Fukushima. And we've got a natural disaster. Again, totally unanticipated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is really good at working inside the box that they've constructed. We haven't had an accident with anything that they've evaluated inside the box. But we've had many accidents caused by stuff outside the box. And what I'm suggesting is we pause, put out the yellow flag and say, you know, keep running, but we're not going to license new reactors to run, or we're not going to license new old reactors to run for an extra 20 years until we figure out what's happening here at Fukushima. I think we have a couple things that we can do. We can petition the government to have a really independent agency take a look at the Fukushima problem and not have it staffed by Nuclear Regulatory Commission employees. They've missed every major accident until after the fact for the last 40 years. We need independent thinkers who can think outside the box and anticipate what's really the worst case. But the other thing I think we need is a freeze on licensing. Some reactors will probably at the end of this process realize that the Fukushima problems are so great that they should be shut down. It might be because of evacuation planning, it might be because of other reasons. But I think we're going to see that. But a pause in licensing right now, where reactors should continue to run, but not be relicensed in a situation like this until the Fukushima lessons learned are there, is appropriate. Not just the old reactors, but also we've got new reactors working their way through through the licensing process with billions of dollars of loan guarantees. We don't need that power now. And now is the time to slow things down rather than grant licenses and ultimately say, oh my God, we made a mistake. But what I'm suggesting is that if you recall back 100 years ago, the French said, never again, it's not going to happen again. And they built a wall between them and Germany. And the wall was called the Maginot Line. And that wall was designed to prevent an attack from the previous war. They were fighting the previous war instead of the next war with the Maginot Line. Well, by building new reactors, I think we're building a new Maginot Line. Technology's changed. We have computers, we have smart grids, we have distributed ways of generating power closer to the grid with not as much waste and much higher efficiencies. So by putting loan guarantees in the process where we've got tens of billions and potentially hundreds of billions of dollars of money on the line, we are creating here in America a Maginot Line. The technology of the 20th century was to build large power plants. The technology of the 21st is not. And what I'm proposing is that by freezing licensing and thinking through these Fukushima large power plants, we may see that we can do it better and smarter with distributed sources of power in the future, and we don't have to build a Maginot Line. Well, I hope we all contact our representatives and ask for a freeze on licensing and ask for an independent agency to come in and evaluate these plants, because I don't believe the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is going to think outside the box. Thank you.
And finally, on the 26th, when building three of the Fukushima Daiichi plant exploded last month, those who saw the video footage were left to wonder why it was more severe than the other explosions. Adding to this mystery were reports that the containment and reactor in Building 3 were still intact. Arnie Gunderson discusses several known facts about Fukushima 3 and theorizes on a possible scenario leading to this explosion. So this is the final segment of Arnie Gunderson's analysis today, April 26.
Good evening. I'm Arnie Gunderson from Fairwinds. We've been getting a lot of emails at Fairwinds on many topics, But one topic's generated an awful lot of questions and concerns and some really thoughtful remarks, and that's what happened at Unit 3? Why did that explode the way it did compared to Unit 1 and all the other reactors on site? So today I want to use that the opportunity to talk about what we know for sure about Unit 3 and a couple of theories about what could have caused the devastation we see at Unit 3. Well, to begin with, the Unit 3 explosion is much more dramatic than the Unit 1 explosion. Now, engineers have a term called detonation, and they have a separate term called deflagration. What that means is they're both explosions in lay terms, but a deflagration is when the shock wave travels at the speed of sound. A detonation is when the shock wave travels faster than the speed of sound. And a detonation is much more damaging than a deflagration. So that may seem like a technical nuance, but it's really the difference between what happened on Unit 1 and what happened on Unit 3. If you look at the plume that was generated at Unit 1, it kind of moves away from the building at a much more leisurely pace than what happened at Unit 3. And I'd like to go into a couple of things we know for sure about Unit 3 and then postulate the reason why I believe it happened. Well, first off, it's obviously a much more massive explosion than Unit 1. The second thing is that there's a large amount of energy that goes straight up. And we would call that a vector. There's an upward vector on Unit 3 that Unit 1 doesn't have. And that's an important clue here we'll get to in a minute. The next thing is that it's clear in Unit 3 that there's an explosion. If you look at the south side of the building, that's the right side of the building, there's a bright yellow flash before the black smoke begins to go upward. That's another important clue we'll get to in a minute. Well, the other thing is that pieces of nuclear fuel rods were discovered as far away as 2 miles from the plant. Now, if you look at Unit 4, which we've talked about in the past, the fuel rods are dry, but the fuel racks are intact. So it's really unlikely that nuclear fuel rods could be thrown from the Unit 4 pool a couple miles away, which leads us to the fact that the fuel that's been found off-site had to come from Unit 3. Well, the other things that have been discovered is that uranium, as a very fine dust, has been found in Hawaii and on the West Coast. Plutonium has been found on the site as a very fine powdery dust. And another element called americium has been found in New England. Well, all of those are what we call transuranics. They're heavier than uranium. And that's an indication of that nuclear fuel was damaged and that nuclear fuel was volatilized at Fukushima. The other things are that photographs of Unit 3 after the explosion indicate that a large portion of the building is missing, especially on the south side. But yet the infrared picture of the same building shows a heat source still on the south side. Well, last but not least is that we're sure, the data indicates that the containment itself and the reactor itself on Unit 3 remain intact. So we've got a mystery here. We've got a reactor and a containment intact, but we know the building was blown to smithereens. Why? I believe that the fuel pool, which is a large 50 by 50 by 50 feet deep container, was empty. And it filled with gases and blew upward. Now, the top of that pool would be open, the sides would be a barrier, and that could be the cause of that upward projection of material. Now, that accounts for a couple more things. But basically, what I'm saying is that the fuel pool is like the muzzle of a gun. It was pointing upward, and it blew upward. And the other thing is, if you look at the photos, there's an awful lot of rubble coming back down. Now that's fuel racks, fuel rods, and pieces of uranium and plutonium. So that accounts for the fact that uranium and plutonium were found as far away as a couple miles off-site. The other thing it shows is that the blackness of that cloud indicates that uranium and plutonium were volatilized. In other words, they were turned into a really fine aerosol, which can find its way across the Pacific, in Hawaii and on the West Coast, and now here in New England as well. So here's the question. What caused that upward force? Well, if it were just hydrogen, a hydrogen-oxygen reaction would create water. And when that happens, the sound wave travels at the speed of sound, and it's a deflagration. That's what happened in Unit 1. It's dramatic, but it's not explosive. What caused the explosion in Unit 3? Clearly there was an explosion for two reasons. One is the magnitude of the plume moving upward, and the other reason is the red flash on the side of a building. A deflagration doesn't give a red flash like that. A detonation does. So the question is, what caused the detonation? A hydrogen-oxygen reaction alone won't do it. There has to be something more here. And the jury is still out on why, but a plausible reason is that a hydrogen reaction started, which then caused a shockwave to move and distort the nuclear fuel in the pool. The distortion of the nuclear fuel in the pool creates a prompt nuclear reaction, which then blows the rubble out of the pool, up in the plume, and creates the energy needed to create the dramatic event that we've seen at Fukushima Unit 3. There is a way to test this hypothesis, and the way to test it is to look at the types of isotopes that are in that smoke. Now, we know the military had planes up, and we can also assume that there were laboratories counting the material. And there's two xenon isotopes, and depending on the ratio, we can determine if it was a prompt criticality or not in that fuel pool. So the evidence is there, but we're not getting it yet. But I would assume that our government has it. Well, thank you very much. And as more information becomes available, I'll keep you informed.
And that was Arne Gundersen of Fair Winds Associates, spelled F-A-I-R-E, winds.com. And you can find all of these recordings in video form with visual aids, very nicely done videos. And you can support Fair Winds Associates' nonprofit wing and help educate people about nuclear power with independent analysis. And you can do that by going to fairwinds.com and clicking on their donate button and making a tax-deductible donation to help the effort. I hope you've enjoyed Politics and Science today. I've been your host, John Barkhausen, and many thanks to Arne and Maggie Gundersen for supplying the material I use today. The preceding show did present the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily reflect an official opinion of any other person or organization. Stay tuned next week for another episode of Politics and Science, and in the meantime, you can find some past podcasts of Politics and Science episodes at radio4all.net. That's radio4all.net. And when you get there, search for Politics and Science.